Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today, we're continuing our series on California and the Civil War by focusing on the Long Walk of the Navajos. Let's get started. We left off last time in looking at Beale's reservation project in the Tejon Ranch in California, and how that particular project influenced the direction that our Captain Carleton was going to take with the indigenous situation in the Southwest. Like the Tejon Ranch, Carleton had a place picked out where he believed he could similarly concentrate Native people to keep them away from the whites and avoid violence and conflict. Before the war, Carleton spent a lot of time traveling around and learning about the landscape. In conversations with Mexican traders and artisans, he heard rumors about an Edenic oasis in the middle of the desert. This oasis was called Bosque Redondo, and was later named Fort Sumner when it was transitioned into becoming a military fort. Carleton wanted to move the Navajo people here, like Beale did with Native people in California. Before we go any further, we need to spend a few moments talking about the Navajo people, as they are the center stage victims here and deserve our attention and focus given what happened to them. The Navajo culture developed its richness and complexity around 1000 AD. Building trade networks and homespun industries, the Navajo people were able to accrue wealth and support a vibrant community and society. The first Europeans to encounter the Navajo were the Spanish. While things were initially peaceful, ultimately the Navajo people came into conflict with the Spanish. This first occurred when the Navajos supported other Indian tribes in the famous Pueblo Revolt, which pushed the Spanish out of the region only temporarily. Less than 15 years later, the Spanish reconquered the Pueblo region and pushed the Pueblo people into Navajo land, where they were effectively refugees. The presence of the Pueblo people in Navajo society and culture led to intermixing of cultures and genetic lines, transforming both people groups at the same time. For example, the intermixing of these two cultures led to the Navajo people adopting livestock in their subsistence agricultural economy. Not only did they use livestock for agriculture, they also used them for tools of transport. The Spanish continued to be a persistent problem for the Navajo for hundreds of years. Many were taken as part of the slave trade in the late 18th century. This system continued well into the 19th century, even after Mexican independence, subbing one conquering people group for another. After Mexican independence, though, a new force encountered the Navajo and created new conflicts. These were American settlers. In the 1840s, the American settlers' arrival led to increased tension with the Mexican government, which, along with other points of conflict, ultimately led to the Mexican-American War, and which permanently would change Navajo society. Now, let's fast forward a little over a decade to the situation with the American military in the Southwest. Back to Carleton. Carleton ordered our old acquaintance from the podcast, Kit Carson, to defeat the Navajo so that they could be forcibly removed, like the Cherokee before them and many other tribes across the United States, to land far away from white people, at least in the short term. Kit Carson ultimately defeated the Navajo through advanced military weapons and overwhelming force, as well as using a scorched earth campaign that resembled what Sherman would do in the Southeast to bring final defeat to the Confederates. This included burning villages, slaughtering livestock, destroying water sources, and many other awful tactics. Tactics that would limit the Navajo's ability to play defense. Now, these tactics were not totally unusual, but they were not common either. The destruction of the Navajo homeland, their infrastructure, their supplies and livestock left them with few choices. They could not continue to fight. Otherwise, the outcome was likely extinction. If they did not fight back, that meant accepting the U.S. terms, which was simple. Leave your homeland and go to where we want you to go, which was, in this case, the aforementioned Bosque Redondo Reservation. The reservation, however, was served as a euphemism for prison camp, in the same way that the term for Japanese prison camps was internment camp. It's another way to say prison. Now, this particular reservation was hundreds of miles away from where the Navajo people lived, and the walk across this desert landscape was extremely dangerous. The U.S. Army literally marched the Navajo people at gunpoint across 300 miles of this desert landscape. Like the Trail of Tears, the journey itself would result in hundreds of deaths over the course of 18 total days of marching. 8,500 people started the march, and only about 8,000 would arrive at this new location. While certainly more people died on the Trail of Tears, that was a much longer march over a longer period of time. Likely, many more would have died, at least proportionally, in this particular march if it had just been a bit longer, as supplies began to run out over the course of the journey. There were a few who managed to escape through mountain passes during this particular effort, but most found themselves in a new place with a new life with limited resources. When the Navajo reached this particular site, they realized immediately that this was not the best land for them to live. First, the water source proved to be not exceptional. The reservation was named for cottonwood trees near the Pecos River. Now, for those who don't know the Pecos River, it is extremely brackish, meaning that it has high levels of salinity, which means it is not suitable water for drinking. The rocks that line the basin of where the Pecos River runs contain salt-bearing rocks and minerals that dissolve and infuse the water. There were also underground salt deposits that disperse into the river. When your body consumes brackish water, your kidneys will overproduce urine in an effort to expel that extra salt your body has accumulated, which leads ultimately to dehydration. Beyond purely being thirsty and in need of actual water, which obviously could lead to death anyway, drinking brackish water could also lead to electrolyte imbalances that cause symptoms like muscle cramps, weakness, and confusion, which are painful in the short term, but in the long term can have such health effects as high blood pressure, heart attacks, and strokes. This was the water source that the U.S. military thought the Navajo would rely on to live in this particular region. Beyond issues with drinking water, the Navajo also faced challenges with food supplies. Amongst all the food that the Navajo grew, corn was the most important. They used corn for a variety of dishes, including roasting, mashing, and much more. Beyond just its dietary significance, it played an important role in Navajo culture. Corn was part of their prayer ceremonies and was often used in blessings. The Navajo even believed that corn played a part in the creation story, and marriage ceremonies often utilized corn to signify union by having the bride and groom eat a mash from different varieties as a symbol. At the reservation, they planned to rely on corn as a staple product, but due to the persistent presence of particular pests, the corn crop failed to meet the needs of the Navajo. So far, the water and the food supplies proved to be wanting. If that wasn't enough, the wood supplies were also inferior to what was promised. As soon as the people arrived, they immediately began felling trees in order to build structures to support their people, but quickly found that there was not enough wood to support the number of houses and buildings that were required to live in this particular region comfortably. The Navajo people were trapped without good water, without stable food, and not enough wood to build the buildings that they needed to live. They were trapped in a barren prison. In spite of all this, the Navajo would end up living on this reservation for years before they were finally allowed to return to their ancestral homeland following the Navajo Treaty of 1868. This, I will say, was uncommon. Most native people who were removed from their homeland would never be allowed to return. The Hot Navajo, by contrast, were fortunately able to return, which likely has less to do with anything specific about the Navajo and more to do with the desirability or lack thereof in the land in question. Now, this treaty is important because I think people need to understand what exactly were the terms that were agreed upon by particular indigenous groups in the United States government in order to really understand the function of these treaties. The first aspect of the treaty was the ceasing of hostilities between the U.S. and Navajo people. It makes sense that violence needed to end before the U.S. was willing to cease military engagement. The Navajo then had to allow U.S. officials to live on the land and oversee the obligations and responsibilities owed to those people. Another aspect of the treaty was the creation of effective boundaries of the permanent reservation land that would be given to the Navajo people, which was in effect the land that they were already living on. This was found in Article 2 of the treaty. Beyond just setting the physical parameters, it also laid out who was allowed and not allowed to visit the land and live on it. The treaty made exceptions for military officers, soldiers, Indian agents, and employees of the government. Additionally, the treaty also created a civilizing process for the Navajo people through the institution of native schools. The treaty required that a plan be put into place to educate native children. Education and civilization in the United States were always intertwined. There were responsibilities for both parties within the treaty. The Navajo were required to enforce compulsory school attendance for all Navajo children between the ages of 6 and 16, and the U.S. government was then required to build the schools and staff them. The most important part of the treaty, though, at least with respect to the U.S. government and U.S. society more broadly, was the permission that the treaty gave to the U.S. government and private industry to build railroads through the designated Navajo land. Here's a direct quotation from the treaty. Quote, "They will not further oppose the construction of railroads, wagon trains, mail stations, or other works of utility or necessity which may be ordered or permitted by the laws of the United States, but should such roads or other works be constructed on the lands of their reservation, the government will pay the tribe whatever amount of damage." The railroads, in many ways, were the final step in the larger project of Manifest Destiny. And ceding the Navajo people the land was a small compensation in order to accomplish this larger goal. In addition to railroads dissecting the Navajo reservation, the U.S. government also wanted the freedom to establish military outposts there as well. In Article 13 of the treaty, it established that this land would be the permanent home of the Navajo people, even though it was bisected, dissected, and split with railroads, military outposts, and schools to civilize native children in the ways of white people. This story of the long walk and the resulting treaty may seem a bit off topic. You might be wondering why this was included in an episode on California and the Civil War, which I think ultimately is a perfectly fair and reasonable question. In many ways, this episode was an effort to connect California and the Civil War to a broader theme and topic called the Greater Reconstruction, which is a term that I discovered and discussed with Elliot West on a previous interview episode. I will now quote from Elliot West in an essay called Reconstruction of the West, published in the Journal of the Civil War Era, that captures the significance of what I discussed today and its connection to the broader period of the Civil War. Quote, "There was, that is, a reconstruction of the United States in the middle of the century, but it was both wider and longer than usually defined. What I've suggested elsewhere as the Greater Reconstruction began around 1845. It proceeded through an expansion that included the U.S.-Mexico War, the first federal efforts to control the new country in the 1850s, the rising strains in the East provoked by expansion, secession, and the horrific bloodletting of the Civil War. This reconstruction continued with the dramas after 1865 of both Eastern reunion and the consolidation of national control in the West, including the military defeat of resistant Indians. It saw the tentative efforts to redefine national citizenship to include former slaves, a slew of Indian peoples, the former citizens of Mexico, a slumgullion of stew of immigrant newcomers, East and West. The whole shebang, covering about a third of a century, more or less reached a semi-resolution at Reconstruction's traditional end of date in 1877. End quote. We will have two more episodes on the Civil War era in California. While I've certainly enjoyed the series, I feel the desire to move on to other topics, but given its weight, I felt it was necessary to give this topic the time that was required. We will see you next time.